Welcome to this episode of Another World is Potable. My name is Peter Bloom, and get ready to emancipate your mind and radically expand your imagination as we present all the most exciting and revolutionary possibilities of our times, both locally and globally. I hope you enjoy it, and as always, solidarity today, tomorrow, and forever. Hi, this is Peter Bloom, and welcome to a new episode of Another World is Potable. This is a very special episode because we're going to be talking about, a really pressing and contemporary struggle that has just emerged, which is around the COVID-19 crisis. And that's where a lot of precarious workers are suddenly finding themselves not just in danger for their own health, as all of us are, but actually really economically imperiled. And what I found at my university is that there are proposals to cut graduate teaching assistants who are primarily PhD students who form a vital and essential part of our teaching. So I wanted to bring on two people who have really helped to lead the campaign to challenge this. First is Anam Qureshi and Amelia Horgan, both of whom are PhD students at the University of Essex. So thank you both for coming on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
So I think, you know, there's so many different ways in which we can think about this, but let's just start at a very basic, like, can you describe what you see as the kind of context, the main issue that has suddenly emerged, if you will, around this?
So I guess the immediate thing is the jobs issue. So the university, its initial kind of communications were things like, we're all in this together, we're all a family, we're going to look to avoid job losses. Then a few weeks later, there's an email sent around mm-hmm. saying, okay, well, we're not doing any more hiring and we are not mm-hmm. likely to have any resource, is how they termed it, for GTA, the graduate teaching role, budgets next year. Mm-hmm. So that kind of created this immediate problem. There had been some discussion prior to that about within the Essex postgraduate community, but more generally as well, amongst PhDs, mm-hmm. about things like extensions and funding extensions and the situation that especially international students are finding themselves in, where they are kind of unable to carry on with their research, but their visas are tied to particular conditions. Mm-hmm. So there was already that discussion happening, and then the jobs issue became kind of very immediate, I think.
So I think just maybe it'd be helpful to give a bit of background, because Amelia, that was a really good description. But so what we have is an already, it sounds like, precarious situation that has been dramatically exacerbated by the COVID-19 response.
I think going back, if you're like trying to contextualize the precarious working conditions for graduate teaching roles and everything, that has been a point of concern for the university for this entire academic year. So in terms of the strikes as well, the UCU actually went on strike twice in this academic year, primarily seeking for better working conditions for graduate roles and then fixed-term lecturers. So having the university management actually email about there being a reduction, not even a reduction, but an entire elimination of budgets for both graduate teaching roles and fixed-term lecturers is adding to the bleak situation that the university is facing currently as well. So you're not even talking about the reduced number of hours that we work for and the reduced salaries that we have, but like not even having that or having mm-hmm. access to that next year. So that it's just like exacerbating the already uncertain and already really unfortunate working conditions that we have. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like setting it to like what really happened and why was there such a reaction or an outpour of like
Yeah,
retaliation
people
against
were very
this?
angry before, and we had had a lot of discussion about how many hours we work versus how much we're actually kind of paid for. So, in my department, for example, we are given 1 hour to prepare a seminar. It's obviously not really possible because sometimes, say, you're teaching Rousseau that week, you can't just read the limited amount of text that you'll be discussing in the class. You have to read around the subject. So, when I kind of me and others in the discussion worked out how long we were actually spending versus how much we were paid for, it worked out less than minimum wage. So, before this kind of happened, everyone was very frustrated about that. And the same is true of marking. If you actually spent the time you were paid to do marking, doing marking, the level of student feedback would be very low. So there was already a lot of anger. Maybe it's helpful for us to talk about how much students rely on graduate students rely on these roles as well financially.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think for many of our listeners who are academic, it would be interesting to maybe just initially talk about what do you mean by seminars and what do actually graduate teaching assistants usually do, and what does it mean to be a PhD student as a graduate teaching assistant?
So I think it's an implicit contract any PhD student signs up for once you are doing your research. A part of it is not is actually having the opportunity to teach, especially if you want to be in academia. And if that is the career path that you're going to be taking, then a part of you becoming an academic also involves you having that platform where you can teach students. And it's part of the entire training program of learning how to research, but also learning how to communicate your research or how to actually teach students a particular module. And so when you talk about teaching roles being available, the role that graduate teachers then play become quite intertwined and like become quite essential as well for the entire working of a university as well. So what do we do as teaching, like graduate teachers? We provide support for full-time lecturers in terms of conducting classes. So you have a lecture which is obviously being conducted by a professor, and then you have a class separately which is led by graduate teaching assistants. And that class is not supposed to be a recap of what the lecture was about, but also talks like goes into more depth about the particular topic for a course that was discussed in that week, right? So we are delivering education or additional education to your students apart from one standardized lecture that they receive for a course. We are the we at times, and I think mostly a lot of GTAs would actually agree to that, that we are the focal point of undergraduate student engagement as well. Our support hours that we provide, students prefer or would prefer coming to the graduate teaching assistant for support and advice or like discussing the module rather than approaching the lecturer. And that then obviously like the entire dynamic of we of us not only providing it like delivering classes or seminars but also being present there as a point of contact for student engagement, providing feedback, marking all their assignments. So there's a lot of work that a GTA actually puts in, and it's not just like an optional aspect of the research that we do of like the of the program that we're part of. But having so many duties within one role actually is like eventually just like piles up to be a really good experience that you might have or a skill set that you will develop as once you graduate from your PhD program.
Yeah, and most PhD students will be in really different financial situations, but almost everyone at some point will need that extra income. So even if you have a full scholarship, that is only about £15,000 a year, which is hard to live on if you have any unexpected expenses, if you have any caring responsibilities, if you don't have a family who support you, say a new bill comes up. So even students who are in the best possible financial situation in terms of scholarship funding will still need these roles financially at times too. And in the even if you have a scholarship, there's a period at the end of it which is not funded, during which you kind of finalize your writing, and a lot of students rely on teaching it going into that year. And the situation is even more grave for students who only have scholarships which cover their fees, or don't have any scholarships at all. And now they're kind of left without the money that they thought they would be able to get through doing these jobs. So it's often seen as just kind of pocket money or topping kind of, I don't know, drinks money or whatever. But actually, for lots of students, it's a major source of income.
I think what there's two aspects that would also provide further context, which is one, the which you touched on as well, and but if this is not just, as you've said, you're doing kind of interesting research for your own work, but actually have PhDs and the graduate community in their roles as teachers and in their roles as researchers played a central role for universities. So I thought people might hear the word assistant, for instance, or they might hear doctoral candidate and maybe have a vision of a kind of just you and your partner, but it might be interesting for you to talk about some of the ways in which intellectually, both pedagogically and research-wise, that PhD students and GTAs really do play an essential function for, everything we do as a university.
I can reflect upon like the way, I mean, in terms of the modules that I've had the fortunate enough to like actually teach them. A lot of my seminars revolve around developing case studies specific to a particular topic that was discussed in class, and that does not require that is not recapping or regurgitating what the lecture was about. That actually involves myself doing some background research on that topic, reading up on it, creating a simulation or a case study that can be discussed in class. And so once you actually do go in class and deliver that and actually discuss with your students, you are trying to take the basic concepts or themes that were discussed in a lecture and actually applying them to a real life thing. Right. And that's doing the entire, like when you're talking about whether it would be a good learning experience for a student to be a part of a class, it is because you are trying to link the theory with and actually practically apply that theory to a case study for that matter. And that is what education is about as well. And that's what I've been actually, the way that I've been taught is not just like taking the theory as it is, but actually having some sort of a practical implication to it, right? Or an application to it. And that's what we do in classes then. We are not, we are trying to stimulate these students like intellectually as well, making them think about the topics, trying to actually apply them to different cases, et cetera. So you are inducing knowledge, you're forcing that, you're creating knowledge as well. And so the connotation, of course, which comes with like the word assistant there is like, well, all that person is doing is administration work and nothing else. Whereas as graduate teaching assistants, we are a core component of the quality education that the university provides to its students. And apart from that, and I think that's only one aspect of the type of work that we do. It's not just create like not just imparting knowledge to students or engaging them specifically, but it is also the support and the feedback that we provide to students, which is not provided by, let's say, or mostly not provided by professors who are leading these modules. Right, so that makes us like essential faculty members of the university as well, not just like people who are assisting in a particular module as per like most like loosely the assistant word that would actually be used for loosely,
And just to
really.
add to that, I think another role is that by having graduates taking some of the teaching load off permanent staff, you have those permanent staff are now given more of a chance to spend on their research as well, which helps the university, helps those permanent staff now, permanent staff next year, they don't have any GTAs, right? So they are spending all of their time teaching, and then they're going to shadow another lecturer. So that's going to negatively affect their research.
Yeah.
Another way is that PhD students often kind of, because they're in the process of specializing to some extent, they're often bringing in exciting new developments in the literature, exciting new ideas, and they're able to bring those to those academic communities, whether that's through their teaching or through participation in seminars, and that they are able to do because they're spending so much time about their research. They're excited by it, they're doing it all the time, they've got more time to spend on their research than anyone else at any other stage in their academic career, right? So they have a kind of this unparalleled moment of excitement and possibly new kind of theoretical directions. And that is something that PhDs and GTA kind of bring to departments too.
I think one thing, and then I want to move to what's actually going on now, and you know, the struggle is perhaps also helping to deconstruct or challenge what may be some stereotypes, which is, you know, you think of PhDs and they're in a quite excellent privileged position because they get to do this research, as Emily, you pointed out, but also, you know, how bad of exploitation can academic work be? Because, you know, it's thinking and reading and writing. And as someone before I did this, I, you know, spent most of my time waiting tables or working, you know, various odd jobs. And I just thought, oh, wow, it'd be great to be an academic. That's like the dream. But what I do think is that what you've seen is a highlighting of how it comes with a lot of both economic and mental health challenges. And you pointed out this, Amelia, in one of your previous answers, but I think it'd be worth talking, is that we're not just talking here about some people losing some pocket change. We're actually talking about people losing, you know, their economic security. But then also, from my own experience 10 years ago, and I know it's probably more so now, you know, this has serious, serious mental health things, even to the extent that without being too morbid, I mean, you know, an increasing number of PhD students are committing suicide. This is something very real. So maybe you could share a little bit about that, because I think when people might hear PhD students, they might not realize that this is precarious labor. And it comes with things that really require our attention.
I mean, and another element is the kind of emotional manipulation from working in a field which people see as based on kind of passion and love, right? You're supposed to love teaching, you're supposed to love your students, you're supposed to give it your all. And if you're not doing that, and if you're not enjoying it, then there's something wrong with you, you're the problem. And then there's a kind of compounding of any mental health stuff there, right? Because you're like, okay, I should be enjoying this. And it also hides the fact that what you're doing is a job. What you're doing is fulfilling in some ways, you're acting as a way of providing the same work that could be done by another member of staff more expensively. And that the fact that there is this kind of idea we have at the university, and that sometimes does exist, of this kind of wonderful free community of shared intellectual inquiry, but then you also have like the real existing university, the actually existing university, which is one of commercial relations just as much, if not more. And that first one is often used coercively to mask the second one, to hide that you're a worker and to hide that you're being exploited or treated badly. And if you try and kind of advocate for yourself as a worker and say things like, you know, where's my contract, or why are we not being paid this, the response is often, well, you know, you're so lucky to be doing this kind of work. Or, you know, if you're a bit higher up in the career than us, if you say you want a temporary teaching job, it's like, well, you know, some of your friends haven't got these jobs, or you're lucky to have this job, or, you know, you need to be quiet because this is for your career development. This kind of stuff, there's this coercion that hides the actual employment relationships of the university, and that's really, really strong as part of the experience of being a precarious academic worker, the kind of soft coercion of having to love the thing you're doing.
Absolutely. I think there's a huge amount of emotional labor that gets exploited in this respect. And I think for anyone thinking, I mean, you are essentially writing a book, and you can imagine, even if it's something you love, that is a very difficult, stressful time as well. So Given this background, I'm going to do something that I haven't done on a podcast, and feel free to share as much as little as you want here. But so, we're in this very extraordinary time. When did you learn that the university was going to cut GTA contracts completely?
There was an email circulated by the Vice Chancellor on the 17th of April, if I'm not mistaken, which actually was start like the subject line was emergency budget. And within that email, where it was explicitly stated that we will not have access to fixed-term teacher or graduate teaching staff budgets moving forward. That was the first official email that was circulated to the entire PGR community that this is a problem. Prior to that, I think there was obviously on social media a lot of other universities trying who had already announced such measures being taken. And prior to that email, I think a group of us initiated an open letter asking for extension for funding and support for all PhD students at the University of Essex. And once that email was, or that open letter was shared with the VC, with the Dean of Postgraduate Research Education, and all the faculty deans, 2 days later, the VC actually sends an email talking about the emergency budget. And I think once that was highlighted, was when the mobilization for the petition, which that we are campaigning for, no cuts for Essex GTA GLA jobs, started. And ever since, it's been since the 17th of April till date, I think we've had a lot of support on that petition. We're continuing expanding it. And we can obviously talk more in detail about what the campaign is, but that was the diamond point where it became real that this is actually happening.
And again, not to feel free to share as much as little, but I think it's important to personalize this. I mean, can you describe when you read that email, like the process emotionally and also politically of just realizing what was being said in this email? I mean, like how did it affect you? Because I think when you read these things in a newspaper or in a petition, it can sometimes just seem like numbers on a page. And a lot of people are suffering right now, but if you were are willing, like how did that feel to be reading that from the university that you're part of?
If I may, I mean, I think I'm just going to obviously give more of a personal experience for myself. I was quite overwhelmed. I am an international student who is fortunate to have a scholarship, but unfortunately, is still like the scholarship is not, let's say, equivalent to what a home student would be benefiting from. And so I get disproportionately affected by by the budget cuts. So if you are actually eliminating, and like GTA roles are my primary source of income. And the minute I actually read that email, the things that I was thinking about, well, I'm not sure if I'll be able to pay rent for the next academic year, and the next, not even the next academic year, but like summer onwards, I have no idea how to sustain living in this country anymore. And that is a lot to take in when you've already been struggling so hard to continue, like trying to make your ends meet, relying on these roles, working. And I think one of the first people to con like I contacted, I sent an email to my supervisor saying, I have no idea what to do anymore. And this is becoming a reality. I might have to go back. I might have to intermit because I don't think I can afford to live in the UK anymore. So that was my reaction towards that email.
And I think that's such a, and I'll open it up for you as well if you'd like to share your experience really, but I think just to put it on pause for everyone here, I mean, imagine being in another country where you are precarious trying to make ends meet and getting an email like that just out of the blue in many ways. I mean, I think that's something we could all share in terms of, it would be overwhelming and it is overwhelming. And I think it's that's one of the reasons I'm doing this episode of the podcast because however else we're going to move forward, I think we have to acknowledge with a sense of care these types of experiences. So thank you for sharing that because I think it is important that we hear these voices. Amir, did you want to add maybe your own views of this?
So my situation is is slightly different. I'm a home student. I have a scholarship which covers the fees and living costs, but I'm going into my next year. I'll be going into the kind of completion period, which the scholarship doesn't cover. When I was awarded the scholarship, I assumed that this period would be covered, right? Because these jobs existed then. We didn't think that they would cut these jobs, right? So I'll be going into that period without enough income, basically. And in other times, there are other jobs available. But it's not as if there are other jobs I could get necessarily, right? Which is a shame because there'll be so many really good researchers pushed out of academia.
I think that there's, two things that were really brought up there that it's worth also just taking a moment with, which is the first is for many people who don't know, I mean, both of you are so close to completing your PhDs, and this is not just something that is 1 or 2 years worth of your work. I mean, this is the culmination for all of us who've done a PhD of decades of education and self-reflection about what it is we want to do and really hard work. So, in a sense, when I'm hearing this, I think it's worth also for listeners who perhaps, have never done a PhD or not, part of the, kind of academic community that the way to realize that, not being able or motivated or, to complete your PhD when you're so close is itself something very debilitating and something, really, really, I think for all of us, it's like in many ways getting close to writing the, spending years and years writing a book and then you're in your final chapter and running out of funds to finish it. Which it kind of make it sounds like, that's a metaphor that's quite literal in this case, in many ways. But I also think that the point that's brought out is, we're at a time now when we need research more than ever for all sorts of reasons, and the crisis really shows that. And I think, it's very dangerous if the only people who can afford to do this high-level research are those who are from a privileged position economically and socially. You think about how many already people and great minds are we, missing their impact because of our existing, inequalities and structural obstacles. So, what though would be potentially good to kind of talk about this now, though, is to think about when you got this email. You mentioned that there had already been a UCU strike, but had there been, was there already an existing kind of PhD community across the different faculties to respond to this? Or is this like a campaign that you've had to build in 2 weeks from the ground up?
I think so. There are two parts to it. The open letter, of course, was the beginning of beginning of the campaign, I would say. And I think that was just to like sort of bring to the attention to the university that we, because of this pandemic, as PhD students are being impacted, and we require the support from the university. And in response to that open letter was the emergency budget being announced. And I think moving from there onwards was when the campaign really took root, where and that's where we built, I think that's where it built up from really. So prior to that, I mean, like, of course, we've had the strikes, and that is like a concern. That is something, it's an ongoing problem that has not resulted in a solution for the working conditions of fixed-term lecturers and GTAs. But apart from that, specific to this pandemic and the response of the university to this pandemic in terms of announcing emergency budgets and like cutting off budgets for teaching assistants and fixed-term lecturers, I think that required the response for that was this campaign.
We hadn't really met before. There had been people had kind of done some people had done stuff in their departments, mainly social sciences and arts and humanities, but okay, we're kind of organizing in online meetings people you've never met, which is a really interesting experience, just thinking about it in terms of the practicalities of organizing. We had set up this GTA GLA group on Facebook before, but it was really the initial open letter and then the budget cuts, which kind of got things going. So yeah, I would say probably we have mainly built it from the ground, created this network quite quickly.
That's really interesting, and one that I think, you know, it's worth kind of explaining more. So how would you say that the online aspect has been both beneficial and also something of an obstacle to being able to create what has become a quite viral campaign?
It's been beneficial in the sense that it's easier to connect with people. It's just, we've just obviously announced a date and a time, and obviously it's agreed upon by a lot of people, and you just like have a Zoom meeting to discuss, and you always have an agenda for that meeting, and we are discussing different aspects of the campaign of how to make it more viral, how to gain more endorsements, how to like move forward in the strategies, how to respond to the university and everything. And it's easier to bring a lot of people together at any given point in time. But at the same time, of course, in terms of as much as we want a lot of people to join in, it's not always possible. And I think we've run into like logistical issues because of that. There are like, despite us trying to devolve it as much as possible, where there's certain people responsible for certain aspects of the campaign, certain teams doing responsible media and communication, others just like looking at writing articles for that matter. It's been like at times it does get overwhelming trying to manage over, I don't know about how media, I think there are over 100 people in the group and in the what, like the chat as well. And just like trying to bounce off ideas of each other as well. It's just like information pouring in at all times, and sort of navigating through that becomes quite
difficult. I'd agree with that. There's one interesting dynamic which kind of helps us, which is that since people's social lives are now almost entirely online, more people are online all the time, and that's good. It makes it easier to share things. It also seems to have lowered the barriers for like joining in a conversation online. So people are talking to people they don't know in a way they wouldn't normally do online, which is helpful when you're running a campaign. And that's been really positive, but it's also exhausting being online, being in meetings. I find it much harder to be in those kind of meetings where you can't really pick up energy from other people. You can't see how people are feeling. If someone's upset, you can't, you know, give them a hug, right? This kind of thing. So that's quite difficult. Yeah. And as Anam said, with the level of the amount of information, the amount of stuff to do, it's quite exhausting. Plus being worried about what will happen financially to all of us, right? So it's emotional and strange, and you kind of feel involved with something that's somehow slightly removed. It's a very strange experience in some ways.
I wonder, like, as well, as someone who has been involved in campaigns and now also researches issues of what I call mobile organizing, is that for all the advantages that you speak about, it might also be harder to foster transformative communities of solidarity because so much of what amounts to online activism is clicktivism and has a very strong sense of voyeurism. So in a time like this, you know, solidarity isn't just we all support each other, but solidarity is also asking serious democratic questions of who's being counted and why, and what does this reveal about underlying social structures? So do you feel that this has been something that has been difficult to establish these kind of strong solidarity bonds? Or do you find that maybe, you know, as you've said, since most people do live so much of their life online now, that some of these issues are just quite generational almost, that actually people are quite comfortable having these very intimate and often challenging and provocative, you know, encounters and engagements with people who, you know, are fighting for the same cause?
I have one of the responses to that is it's like unprecedented times right now, I think. And having something like a budget cut to your primary source of income, as a lot of people actually talk about it, being associated with these roles, taken away from you, not having a human interaction, but like actually just like meeting virtually to discuss this and everything. So everyone's definitely taken aback by it. I think all PhD students, despite where they are in the UK, are going through the same thing right now. And it is, and a lot of them have various reasons for why they might be affected by it. And so to an extent, that solidarity, of course, is understanding what these roles mean for us and not have like lacking the access to them, what the negative repercussions that would arise from that. And so it's easier to like have that genuine solidarity for this particular cause because everyone feels the same way. The other aspect to it, of course, is with regards to whether, apart from PhD students, when you're talking about professors or lecturers or the management, do they understand it? Does the general audience actually understand the problems of or the repercussions that these role, the lack of these roles will actually have? And there we do see at least few of the departments in the university have endorsed our petition. They do understand the having them, obviously being academics, I think they do realize the importance of these roles in the university overall. And so that's where you get that support. As an or like a general public, I'm not sure, Amelia, would you have anything to say, like whether they do agree to our cause, or would they actually show us, like have feel the same way about this particular thing?
I think people are shocked to hear about the scale of job losses and the callousness of the university's priorities, so starting at the bottom. But I think there is and I don't blame people for this, right? I don't expect people to know the kind of inner workings of the university, but I think people tend to assume that someone who's got an academic job at a university is probably well-paid and financially secure. It makes sense people think this.
Yeah.
It's a professional job. But I think the kind of extent of precarity within the university is not understood by the general public. So I think there's some kind of confusion about exactly how much, how dangerous this a situation this puts people in. And the same with kind of temporary teaching posts. And I think one thing that I really want to get across is that there's something kind of totally ridiculous about so management knows that every year they need to rehire someone to do the same course, right? But they don't make this a permanent role, just in case the situation comes up or there's a fluctuation of student numbers and they have to hire that person. So you have people who are on temporary contracts for a decade, for years and years and years. And I think people, the general public, aren't necessarily aware of that. And I mean, universities don't want that to be known. And I think people should be shocked by it because that's also their money. It's public money which is paying for this. It's public money which is creating these really, really poor working conditions. And people should be outraged that their taxes are being siphoned off to people who are earning much more at, while damage is done within supposedly public institutions to people at the bottom. Yeah, so I think there's not necessarily that much knowledge about the conditions of the university, but I don't blame people for that. Universities are, you know, especially at the moment, in the last few years, they've become really, really sealed off in many places. They've been really securitized. Members of the public can't just kind of wander in and take part in that community, which is a real shame. So I don't blame people for not understanding that.
And one thing, though, is so I think you've mentioned that these are kind of systemic issues of precarity, which are in universities and impact the entire economy, unfortunately. I mean, we are now largely a precarious economy, and you do see huge amounts of inequalities about, you know, what I would call executivization, about how there's, you know, I've actually, for my sense, written a book about this, sort of about this myth of the CEO and how, you know, actual evidence shows that executives and CEOs make very little difference in terms of actual performance of an institution or organization and the value they provide. Mm-hmm. And yet they're increasingly, you know, the highest paid and also have a mythology around them as the people who can most deliver, you know, our salvation, whether that's at a workplace or whether that's increasingly at a national and global level politically. But I did want to ask, like, you can almost imagine if you were given the other side to say, okay, well, this crisis happened, And there was a kind of knee-jerk reaction, or I don't want to say that because we don't want to know, we don't necessarily know the processes, but there was a decision made to cut GTAs. And then there was a campaign, and there was a real clear sense of that a lot of people felt that this was a cutting of an essential part of our community that would have really profoundly negative impacts for our students, for our research, and for society. And you can understand potentially that, these are difficult times and universities have made decisions. And, how would you, though, in your own views or the views of the campaign, feel that the university has responded now that I think some of these concerns have been raised? Like, do you feel that they kind of said, okay, well, we had to make a decision and now we're rethinking it? Or do you feel like there hasn't been types of openness and response that you wanted? I mean,
I
how
think
would you
one thing
describe the
we've had
university
is
response to this?
quite a lack of transparency in communications. So we said, okay, you've told us that there's no budget for our roles next year. So what you're telling us is that you're cutting the roles. And they then send around an email saying, aha, we have not cut the roles. All we have said is that we almost certainly will not have the budget for them next year, as if we kind of made some mistake. And this kind of sense of uncertainty, they're not being kind of straightforward with us and saying, like, look, we've done it, we've cut the rules. When they've given us the best case scenario figures, in the best case scenario, which is incredibly optimistic, there is no money for these rules. So there's a kind of, they softened the language to say, no. We might try, but we did tell you that there's almost certainly none, which I've personally found quite frustrating because if someone is going to, cut your job. You want to know as soon as possible, so you can try and find alternative arrangements. And instead, we've had this kind of no, you've got it confused. We're not cutting them, which is also kind of for some of the for the people for some academics who tend to have a more kind of positive view of management of universities in the UK. They have said, oh, no, they've changed their position. They now kind of have, they're now reviewing the situation on GTAs, which isn't true. They're saying, if I say, if you ask me, do you want to go swimming tomorrow? And I say, almost certainly not, but ask me tomorrow and I'll confirm. That doesn't mean that I've in any way, like, I'm likely to go swimming, right? And that's the situation we're in. And that's been really, really frustrating. There's a lack of transparency. As is so often the case in universities, things focus much more on PR and how things appear than talking about what their honest actual priorities are. And what I would like to see is instead of kind of these statements of like, we've don't worry, we have a hardship fund, which is maybe, and I can talk about more, but it's not really suitable for the situation we find ourselves in. Is them kind of being honest about what is actually going on, and changing their priorities, which are to being, we want to stay in control of the situation, to something like we want to make sure all the people we employ and all of our students get the best we can give them. And there was another bit of news which is relevant today, which is that there is some money from the government to support universities. And Essex, before these details were published, said, we're not interested, which perhaps there's good reason to not be interested. Perhaps there are strings attached. But I personally found it quite galling when the universities got rid of your job that they're then saying, well, we're not going to be taking any support. That I found personally quite difficult to stomach.
I mean, indeed, it is the uncertainty from the university side, the lack of transparency, where they're not communicating the decisions that they've actually made. And it is, maybe I am being cynical, but I am certain that the decisions have been made. And it is just trying to soften the tone of the messages that you convey, and also sort of the ambiguity which would keep us at bay, which is like we're not really cutting them off, we are uncertain. In regular times, this line of message obviously frustrates us as well, but you can get through them. But the uncertainty with this pandemic specifically, not being clear about the decisions that you've made, not actually responding to the fact that even your best case scenario does not have a budget for GTAs or fixed term lecturers, is problematic. And it's not about finding a one-time solution. So the voluntary cuts that the higher management is planning on taking or is willing to take, or the hardship fund that the university is announcing, is not really alleviating the problem that we're talking about GTAs not being present for, let's say, one academic year, right? So, like, how much can you actually offer? Like, how much is this hardship fund really going to benefit any one of us when it's almost inaccessible to GTAs or PhD students generally? The amount of effort that goes into accessing this is already taking a toll on a lot of people's mental health. So, I mean, it's not like providing a hardship fund as a PR strategy is actually solving the long-term problem of me not having a job, which is going to provide an income for the rest of the year, right? So it's just like, how is that how is that even a solution to when we're asking reverse your decision to not cut GTA posts because they're not just a source of income, but like obviously a primary source of income in addition to a lot of other things. The solution that the university gives, oh well, we're giving you £500 to access, and that should be fine. So it's not even like responding, like being like actually thinking about whether what good is this amount going to do for me, and for how long am I supposed to survive on this amount of this one-time cost.
One of the also, I think, important things here is that you mentioned, that there was an emergency budget announced, and then there's some kind of ongoing discussions around this. It would be good to kind of provide for all of us, I think, an understanding, what is the UCU's view, like involvement in this? Who's making these ultimate decisions about the budgets, and how might this ask, be, if I'm being constructive or optimistic, an opportunity for thinking about the different ways in which we can actually create kind of democratic mechanisms
I think this is a
for
really
creating
interesting
university
question
budgets.
because universities are much more democratic officially than so many other institutions, including public institutions, much more than private companies. You have these bodies which through which decisions must be made. You have guaranteed representation. I can't speak about the Essex situation particularly. I don't know enough about that. I know you have been involved in the discussions to some extent, but because of the emergency nature of this, it seems like in many places what's happening is senior managers are meeting. They're not using these routine processes where things would have to go through university senates, other bodies like that, where you would have proper consultation. They're not using those in the normal ways they would. Another thing is that in several student unions, who might be the kind of people who would say, no, we don't agree with this, student union officers have been furloughed, so they're not able to speak out about this. So you have that situation where you don't have, normally you might have some opposition. I think, so we have this kind of democratic shell, but it's not functioning properly because of this emergency situation. You have senior management saying, no, we must do this. And the other thing is just how much people have bought into this idea of there being no alternative, just how widely held this belief is. People genuinely think that when someone important tells you, we've looked at the budgets and there's nothing we can do, a lot of people think, okay, well, that must be the case. And that attitude is quite hard to fight. It's quite common amongst academics. Academics believe very strongly in the value of expertise. So when they think management must also be seeking expertise. They must have listened. They must have thought about things. And this is genuinely what should be happening. And that view is quite hard to fight against, to say, look, our interests are not always the same as management. This might be one of those moments. So that's quite hard to fight those attitudes. I think it shows that, and I mean, Essex is a really interesting example here because it was set up to be this kind of small democratic community. There is one building where all of the academics, all of the staff, all of the students used to eat together, sit and eat their meals together, right? Now, of course, we have a few cafes where people isolated eat. So you can see how far the idea of the university has changed from when it set up in the 60s to now. And it's supposed to start out as this, of course, doesn't always live up to this. It's supposed to be this kind of democratic space where there is this participatory decision-making. But that is thrown out of the window generally under neoliberalism, but under a neoliberal moment. And in that a moment of extreme crisis, it just goes completely.
Another aspect that is, I think, key here then is to think about, well, so the long-term systemic things are things that I think we need to have ongoing kinds of campaigns and discussions about. And I do have to say that I think with this crisis and with the financial crisis previously, a lot of the types of ways in which certain knowledges, like you brought up, Amelia, about, you know, well, you know, they've said that this is the budget, so this is exactly what we can and can't do, have been challenged, right? We realize that these are political questions. We realize that these are questions that have, you know, they're not ideologically neutral. But in the short term, I mean, I think people may have, and, you know, this impression that, okay, well, what can you do? I mean, you know, student numbers are going to go down, et cetera. So what would you see some really strong ideas and ways for moving forward? Like if you were able to, you know, be in a room with senior management and you said, let's come together with a solution because we have to recognize that, you know, if we're all acting in good faith and we all want the best for our community, and we all want the best for our students, and we all want to provide the best research, that GTAs are essential. What are some things you think the university can do?
I mean, one idea that has been thrown around is, okay, we have the ref soon, we want to produce really good research. How do we balance producing good research with guaranteeing jobs for GTAs and temporary lecturers? Why don't we give permanent staff research leave so that there is more work available? Why don't we start from the basis that the thing we need to do is protect jobs? That's one of the things that could be done. Salary caps, salary ratios, the rate of pay of the highest paid people in universities has been exploding in recent years. It's obscene. Money that no one needs to live on, private healthcare, all of these kind of things, right? But houses, kind of grace and favor houses, this sort of thing. Expenses, budgets, things that people genuinely don't really need. These could be places where people look first rather than temporary staff.
No, I think those are all really, really constructive and pretty obvious ideas. I wish there were
clearly more obvious with us than like to us than the management.
The other thing is that there are things the university would need to be demanding from the government, which is that the way in which the funding system works in the UK, well, in England, is that you have universities hugely reliant on student fees. So I think Essex, about half of its income comes from student fees. And this is going to cause huge problems. So obviously now this is causing huge problems, but even in a normal year, this can cause huge problems. There were fewer 18-year-olds born one year, for example, and that caused a mini financial crisis for several universities. Demanding that we have a funding system that isn't based on student fees and competition in the long term is the most important thing. And one thing that's quite worrying is a lot of the kind of there's a lot of discussion about value for money degrees. I study philosophy. I don't think that can ever be a value for money degree. but I think universities should be communities of the creation of knowledge, the sharing in that, and that is never something which is really good value for money. So it's really countering those narratives and not buying into those. And I'm not sure I've seen enough of that from university vice chancellors saying like, look, this is important. This is a social good that needs to be defended. And it needs to be properly funded because the fees model is totally unsustainable. Even very wealthy universities have about a third of their income Basically everywhere apart from Oxbridge is not completely too strong, but it's very dependent on fee income. And they're going to be everyone is hugely challenged by this moment. But in a way, the funding model we had is not sustainable anyway. And this has just thrown that into relief. It was likely that, you know, these crises would have happened. You have universities in huge debt. They've taken out debt to buy things to attract more students on the basis that there will be students in the future. Now there aren't students next year, but this crisis has just been brought forward rather than being something totally new.
I think it's, again, a really crucial and significant point that you're dealing with, I think, a very unreliable and unfair funding model, particularly for something that is a public good, not just a private good. So, you know, universities, and we're seeing this. I mean, who's going to provide the research for vaccines? Who's going to provide the research for ensuring that we meet the challenges of COVID-19, right? It is not corporations. It is not business. I mean, you know, it is university researchers, right? And in this respect, then, it sounds to me that there is a kind of short and medium and long-term demand. The short-term, I think, is what we said, that, you know, if we have an emergency situation, why not have a cap, not a voluntary one, but a hard cap on incomes at 100K, potentially, and then say, which would free up money to, you know, make sure that we have the GTAs. And then also have a ratio of, like, I think you mentioned 5-1, which I think is very fair, right? Secondly to that, I think the point about, you know, trying to make sure that we actually create spaces for teaching, especially during this time when research is more needed than ever. So, you know, right now, instead of potentially limiting research leave, why not expand research leave for researchers and then give this opportunity for actually GTAs and early career researchers to teach? I think the other aspect, though, is, you know, right now the government, you know, I think one thing people don't realize is that the government actually spends more money on universities based on a fee paying than they do. They just funded that directly. And there's all sorts of reasons because they have to securitize the loans. They have to give quite a bit of kind of different subsidies to universities because we do fulfill a major, major role. I mean, it's our research that helps to move societies forward. And it's our teaching which does the same thing. So in a certain sense, you know, I think you're right that there are systemic ways of saying our current funding model hasn't been working for decades. It's a failed experiment.
Yeah, and there's one easy trick to do that, right? Which is tax people who earn more money. Tax them properly.
Yes.
It's one quick.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I think, there's a variety of things that I think on a broader level we really could fight for here. And, you know, one of them is a seriously more progressive tax regime.
Absolutely.
I think another thing is just a democratization of the economy in general. But what I wanted to end with before asking you guys, both of you, a final question is, though, just to bring it back. I mean, I think that one thing I've been hearing that the campaign has kind of made is that, yes, there are differences of interest potentially, but there are actually solutions here, even in the short term, that would make a difference. And I kind of, one of the reasons that I wanted to bring the personal part out was because, yes, we do want to talk about these long-term systemic issues, but we also want to bring it back that, like you said, Denham, for you, for like, this is something that you have 2 months maybe, right? Like, we need to be thinking about solutions that allow us to save the people who are going to most be able to contribute to these long-term solutions. So I think that, you know, in this sense, would you say that you would really like the universities to start considering some of these solutions that will actually provide us a basis for getting rid of uncertainty and also securitizing, you know, in a very insecure time economically and socially, you know, your well-being?
I mean, I would start with the university actually acknowledging that this is a serious concern that the BGR community actually feels. And it's not something that can be brushed off or ignored as it has been for this time. And accepting, acknowledging that, and then moving forward with actually providing alternatives or even considering that there are alternatives, more fairer solutions that we can work around rather than short-sightedness that has been demonstrated by the management till date. And I think that's something that is lacking, and that's what frustrates me and angers me on a daily basis. Is it is amazing to see a campaign actually take root and actually expand within a few weeks. The amount of solidarity that we actually have from other universities from across the globe as well is tremendous. I mean, the coverage that we've gotten in media has been is exemplary. And regardless of that, you have the university management not acknowledging that this is a real issue that PhD students who are supposed to be one of the core components of the University of Essex as well, and the is disheartening and disappointing at the least, and it's shameful as well that this is the response that we get from them.
So I think that what I'm hearing is, whether it's shameful or not, in a sense, like that at the very least, the first step is to acknowledge the pain that it's causing and the issues that this is causing. And then it sounds like, and I think I'm just going to share my own views and here is that we need to recognize that the role of GTAs and PhD students and their importance to our community is non-negotiable. Right, they are not expendable, and I think that's something that also would be very helpful, because once you understand that they're essential, then I think I don't think anyone would immediately say like, okay, look, all of us have to potentially make ch sacrifices. This is a changing time, and I'm not saying that, but the acknowledgement that what you do is essential and that we have to find solutions for you, as opposed to thinking of you as expendable. I mean, I
I
think that
mean,
also sounds like
yeah, I mean, I think it's
incredible.
just like the message like that needs to be taken away from this is that GTAs of external lecturers or GLAs for that matter are not disposable cheap labor, but they're actually essential faculty members. And it is understanding that these that we do form or we can be categorized as essential faculty members is the only way forward when you actually talk about making budget adjustments and so forth is once you've already recognized us as being essential faculty members, then maybe when you announce emergency budgets in the future, you will not actually eliminate them entirely.
Absolutely. So I want to just ask one final question, and give you spaces. For those listening to this, whether they're kind of just everyday listeners, whether they are academics, or even whether they're in positions where they could make a differences, what are ways in which they can support you?
Well, share like support the campaign. We have the campaigns. Obviously, we have like a lot of attention on social medias. We have the Twitter, like we have our own Twitter page where we are sharing updates on the campaign. So Essex GTAs, follow that on Twitter. We have our Instagram page, No Cuts to GTAs. We have a Facebook group as Facebook page as well, No Cuts to Essex GTA Job. So in terms of like supporting, sending messages of solidarity, and just communicating it with other colleagues and friends, I think that's one way where the general audience can actually support the campaign, also become more aware of the fact that this is something that is not exclusive to this university, but is being faced by a lot of other students in various universities across the UK. And I think like that's one way of going forward.
Yeah,
Amelia, anything
I
else?
think what is really, really important is for people connected to Essex to really share our campaign, sign stuff, get involved wherever they can. Academics in general, I think there's a really brilliant campaign organized primarily with some universities in the US, which is high profile academics saying, look, I'm not going to give any talks or work at any university which has treated temporary, contingent, precarious staff badly during this crisis. And I think that's the kind of thing we really need to be doing, saying, look, this isn't okay. You don't have to do this. I think many academics are kind of naturally conformist. They're the kind of people who are good at school. That's how they end up being academics. And I think a lot of people need to think about exactly what management's interests are in this moment and how they might differ from their own or how they might differ from precarious staff members. And really, really think about that and really think, well, what can I personally do, especially if you're someone who has the security of a permanent job, and think, what can I do in this situation? Mm-hmm. Where can I say no? Where can I stand up? Where can I make sure these voices are heard? Not just saying, oh, isn't it a shame that this has happened, but really, really helping us put up a fight, using any leverage they have, and not just thinking that this will all blow over once this crisis is gone, because nothing will ever be the same. This is a moment in which people looking to profit from the financialization of universities, from the marketization of universities, will be able to do that in unprecedented ways if we don't put up a good fight now. So Essex is the first university in the UK to announce these cuts to this extent. And obviously that's very, very callous, but there's no reason to think that the university you work at won't be next. They're more concerned about looking bad. Essex doesn't mind announcing this so quickly. And I think it's really important that we contextualize this in the way that contemporary capitalism puts the risk on precarious workers. Consider like a temporary lecturer, they're only paid for 9 months a year. The rest of that time, that risk is on them, that financial risk. And that risk is, we've really seen that increase during this moment. So the university, which knows that these jobs normally happen every year for GTAs or for temporary lecturers, and that they're not actually temporary. There's always a need for these jobs, has said, no, there never was a need. This is on you. And also look to the ways it's affecting non-academic workers. The university, a kind of subsidiary part of the university, tried to not offer decent support to workers in the catering department at Essex. And there was a really wonderful campaign. And they're now being offered much better terms, which is great. But the main message I have is that Essex will be the first of many. And for people, the kind of public at large, I think when we think about universities, we often think about, okay, well, that's where people go if they're lucky enough when they're 18. And they go and study, and isn't that nice? And we want to make sure that they have a nice time. But the reality is that in many parts of the country, universities are the biggest employer in that city or that region. They're one of the biggest landlords. They own many spaces. They are these kind of really important institutions in different areas. And if this, we cannot allow them to treat their workers in this kind of way. They're not merely places where people go and study. They are employers, and they are huge parts of the economy. So we shouldn't try and see this as an individual problem. This is a huge, huge structural problem. And we need to think about how we can protect those universities, not just as places where undergraduates study, but as employers, as centers of learning, and also open them up and democratize them, make them not just what they were. We don't want to just say we want to go back to how things were last year, because last year was already a crisis, right? Last year we were already on strike. We want things to change fundamentally. And we want university managements to also say, look, we know the situation we're in is a disaster for us. We're not financially resilient. We need to work together to come up with creative solutions to solve this, rather than just doing what the most kind of stereotypical city kind of banker would do, which is, okay, we'll just cut the lowest paid precarious jobs first. So we want them to think creatively. Mm-hmm. We want them to think intelligently about how can we guarantee that we will continue to be resilient, we will continue to protect those jobs. And they're not doing that at all. They're transferring the risk to the most precarious workers. So for people at Essex, get involved, for academics in general, get your head out of the sand and think about how this is going to affect your institution, because it will happen at your institution next. And for the public at large, try and reconceptualize the university. It's not just a place where people go to study. It's an employer, it's a landlord, and it often is a very unfair one as well.
So I really want to thank both of you. I think, you know, what you are doing is so important, and, you know, any ways in which we can support you and show solidarity. And, you know, try to find what I think is a really important constructive short and long-term solution to these is vital. So there is another world to win. Both of you are showing every day, both in your research and what you're doing right now, that you're crucial to that.
Yes,
and
thank you so
thank
much.
You thank you for having us here.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Another World is Potable. My name is Peter Bloom, and remember, until next time, another world is not only possible, but happening right now.